Welcome to the Social Podcast, where no discussion or debate is off limits.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Social. It is Tuesday, and we are so excited to welcome to the show a wonderful panel filling in for Cynthia all week. She is a writer, broadcaster, comedian, and also recovering lawyer. The one and only Candy Palmiter is back. Hi, Candy.
Hello, everyone. I always miss seeing Cynthia's beautiful face, but thrilled to be here in her stead.
Awesome, always to have you. Hey, we'd also like to welcome to the panel today stand-up comedian, actor, broadcaster, the very talented Ali Hassan. Welcome to The Social.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I can tell already it's going to be an extra good, extra funny show. So let's start with the Olympics. Canada's medal count just keeps growing, and the Toronto Star's editorial board is arguing that athletes deserve to be paid more. They say the Olympics bring in billions, and the IOC spends only 4% of its revenue on athletes. So should athletes be making more for participation in the Olympics?
Well, I can weigh in on this. I mean, I find that almost insulting, that 4%. I'm so out of shape. If I ran a 5K right now, I would expect some kind of pay, chocolate, beer. We're in cottage country right now. I was swimming in a lake. And when I got out of the lake, I was like, where are the flowers? Someone should be celebrating this.
Where's your medal? Why not? Come on.
Yeah, where's my medal? And if I think I deserve a medal, how can I not apply that same logic to these incredible elite athletes who've devoted so much and sacrificed so much for their sport? So absolutely, they should be paid more.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ali, if I ran that 5K, I'd need defibrillators, not roses. So, but, you know, this has been talked about. The NCAA is talking about this. Should the bodies making the money, earning the money, be actually getting the money? You know, it reminds me of Chris Rock's great joke when he talked about the difference between wealth and richness. And he said, Shaquille O'Neal, he's rich. The white guy that signs his paycheck, he's wealthy. And that has been a discussion in the Olympics, you know, for years and years. It was back in 1988 when they finally let professional athletes play in the Olympics. But during the Cold War, there was all this discourse around, in the communist countries, they were being paid for jobs as landscapers, but they were actually being paid to be athletes, while our athletes weren't being paid. If I think back to my Olympic hero, Jim Thorpe, who was arguably one of the greatest athletes of all time, the first Indigenous man to receive gold medals for the USA, he competed in track and field, won a big bag full of medals. Then somebody outed the fact that he had been in semi-pro baseball, and they stripped him of all his medals. He went on to play professional baseball, professional basketball, and after his death, they give his medals back to his kids. But, you know, to me, if you are the one earning the money, right, your body is what's putting the bums in the seats, then you should get some of that money. Those people at the top, white-knuckling that cash, they got to let it go.
So who should, money come from? Where should the money come from?
Ticket sales, some from the IOC.
Well, it seems reasonable, right? Like, this is a compelling argument they're making, because they say, like, just 4% of this annual revenue is going to athletes for scholarships and grants and awards. And they compared that to professional leagues that give around 50% of the revenues back to athletes. So it seems reasonable that the IOC could spend less on promoting itself and put more money into the pockets, as you said, Candy, of the people putting on the show. But guys, the IOC is a business, like a big business. Show me a big business that splits the profits fairly. I don't know if this is ever going to happen.
It's supposedly, a nonprofit. It's registered as a nonprofit.
Yeah, but sure. Okay, sure. But even that editorial, even the Toronto Star editorial sort of was like, wah, wah.
Yes, agree. But we can eye roll that, but that's the official status.
My whole thing is, aren't athletes needing the money before they get to the Olympics? I think that's the biggest question I have. It's one thing to get to the Olympics, but we all know that these athletes are training for years and years and years, in some cases decades, to be able to even qualify for the Olympics. So I feel like, you know, yeah, there might be a discussion that the IOC might be on the hook for a little bit, but I actually have to pivot and say, where are the governments and what are the requirements that the IOC is asking of participating countries in terms of their support? Because these athletes, the majority of them, at least according to one statistic I found, over 60% of athletes who are applying for various grants and funds and scholarships, 62% of them are what they have in the net income bracket, negative net income bracket. In other words, these are people who are kind of like the working poor who can't afford their basic training, are working all these other jobs just to be able to even qualify. So my thing is, we should be looking at how the countries, maybe how Canada is supporting athletes well before they're even getting to the IOC level.
But you might letting the rich people off the hook there, Melissa. You know, I mean, I think absolutely governments play a role in this. But I'm just reminded of the Amazon format, where it's like, the working poor and the athletes at 4%, they're effectively the working poor here. And Candy, I don't know if this is what you were going to say, but I obviously think about stand-up.
Yes.
And, I don't know if you have the same philosophy I do, but my perspective is if I'm doing a show and no one's getting paid, meaning the producer, the promoter, nobody's getting paid, it's all going to charity, I am fine with that. But as soon as someone is getting paid, we all better get paid. That's the way
absolutely.
I look at it.
Okay, so,
and
but then
gonna,
who gets
if you're gonna
what?
If you're going to put my name on the ticket and charge a price for that ticket, then I better be getting paid. And exactly, if the guy bringing craft services in and the guy bringing the lightings in is getting paid, then as the talent, I want my paycheck at the end of that night. I don't work for free.
But then, okay, so let's get to brass tacks. If the IOC is going to be on the hook to pay some athletes, who deserves what? Do you have to be a certain ranking, like maybe, I don't know, world top 20? What about for the dark horse that people don't see coming and then all of a sudden starts winning all these medals? So how do you start to determine what athletes get what payment? Does everybody get the same? Do you start to rank it?
You bring up a good point. Like, there are a lot of people who believe that meddling athletes should be paid. Right? Like right now, there's no prize money for meddling. And, there's an argument for and against.
Not from the IOC, but Canada pays our athletes.
Right. No, but the IOC doesn't pay for athletes who win medals. And so some people are wondering whether or not that's an option. There are downsides and upsides to everything. The bottom line, though, is you bring up a good point, Mel. How does the payment scale be? Like, how do you execute it if you're the IOC? Putting that aside, given that is a complicated conversation, we do know that the IOC, even though it's a nonprofit organization, has so much money and also is not giving enough money to athletes and also restricting athletes with what money they can make independent of what the IOC gives them. So there are all kinds of brand sponsorship restrictions on athletes who compete in the Olympics imposed by the IOC. For example, if you are lucky enough to be a sponsored athlete, you can only make 7 thank yous, personal thank yous to your sponsors. And those thank yous are very, very meticulously set out in terms of you can't use the logo, you can't call yourself an Olympian, you can only call yourself a champion, you can't do this, you can't do that, because the IOC says, and this is the joke, the IOC says they don't want to over-commercialize the Olympics. I'm sorry. I'm watching every Olympic event
there,
and I'm seeing logos all over the place. Like, this is what's maddening.
Who would never touch a hamburger, shove a hamburger in their mouth.
This is what's maddening. Like, I get it, Mel. Maybe it's like not the IOC's entire responsibility to like fund the athletes, but at least start restricting and loosening all these protocols and not stop athletes from going to get their money where they can get it.
And yeah, Lane, just jumping on what you're saying.
They got there, though. But they got there. My only thing is that it doesn't have to be, like, I get what you're saying, that it's really important for an athlete to thank their sponsors. But the point is they got there, and they didn't have to waitress on the weekends to get to the Olympics, if they potentially have, if they're one of the very few lucky ones that have those big sponsorships. And so many athletes have had to turn to things like monetizing their social media accounts just to be able to pay for their nutrition, their supplements, their coaching.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know if the government should be held accountable for everyone pursuing the dream, our dreams. Like, we waitress, we work jobs, we work retail.
No, but
how about here's the analogy? How about here's the analogy, right? Like, there are certain sports that don't have leagues. And the only time people in these sports can shine is every 4 years in the Olympics. So the analogy to me, Mel, would be it's like schooling and education. You'll waitress and you'll hustle and you'll pump gas and whatever throughout school to supplement your education and your training.
Great analogy.
for the goal of getting a job with a bank or a corporation or whatever, where they pay you the big bucks. The bank in this case, where you get your job, is the Olympics. The problem is the Olympics don't write the check after you've put yourself through school.
But let me just take that analogy one little bit further. Let me just say this. Instead of it being the job, the bank, the IOC can be a university. So I starved to death through law school, 3 years. But at the end, when at graduation, I make awards. I get awards for highest standing in something, or I get awards for something. There are money prizes attached to those awards. So I am rewarded for my 3 years of work. And once you start rewarding, yes, it's hard for the starting athletes, but eventually everybody will catch up and be on the money train, except for those big guys at the top.
Oh, gosh. Let's put a pin in this, because, you know, there's another question. Like, are athletes competing for money now and not awards? That's a whole other discussion. We blew the whole first segment on this. That is how compelling everybody's thoughts are. I love this.
So Mary Simon was officially sworn in as our 30th Governor General yesterday. A prominent Anuk leader and former ambassador, Simon is the first Indigenous person to become the Queen's representative in Canada. So what do you guys think? Will this historic appointment give a, what is considered like a largely ceremonial position, new teeth?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, there's a part of me that hopes so. But when you look at the history of this position, it really is largely ceremonial. I think this position is supposed to transcend politics. And so therefore, by definition, this role sort of sits neutrally on top of the government as the Queen's representative. And I know that there are critics who are saying, well, hold on, is this, you know, a little bit of a show? All show, no go, that this is, you know, definitely a government that has said they want to make truth and reconciliation with Indigenous peoples a priority. So is this sort of just a symbolic appointment with having Mary Simon in this role? And can she actually do anything outside of that? That remains to be seen. What I can say is, in terms of representation and what I've been reading and seeing in the news from the Inuk communities, both in Nunavut and in Ottawa, they're celebrating. They're really celebrating the fact that one of their own is in this position. And so many leaders saying, this is what representation looks like. This is someone who's now going to be a role model, not just for Inuk girls, but for all Aboriginal or Indigenous women and girls. And that means something. And it reminded me of another woman of color, the first woman of color who was ever in this position. That was Adrienne Clarkson. I was in my, I think, early 20s. And this was the first person in government in a prominent position that I remember as a young girl saying, oh, my gosh, you can do that? Like, you can get there? And this woman looks actually very similar to my own mother. And I had never seen that representation in our Canadian government up until that point. And that said something to me. So if I can kind of remember that feeling, I can't imagine maybe what a young Inuk girl is thinking, seeing Mary Simon in that position today.
That reminds me of Mary Simon coming in.
We're all on it.
We're all excited. We're all excited about this.
I was having that same feeling when Kim Campbell was prime minister for 5 minutes. And I thought, oh, my goodness, a woman can run it all. So, you know, you have those moments. And I'm happy and proud. A couple of big wins lately. We've got our first national chief of the Assembly of First Nations. Never, ever happened before that a woman's taking that position, Roseanne Archibald. But I am in a catch-22. Because that position represents, the position of Governor General represents the colonizer. I've had people ask me, if you were ever asked to sit, would you? I would not. I would respectfully decline, because the colonizer has its foot on my neck and I cannot play ball by representing that person. Having said that, you know, I don't want to disrespect Ms. Simon, and I know there's a lot of excitement. There was excitement in New Brunswick when Judge Great Nicholas, a Maliseet man, became their Governor General. But I just really worry that this is going to be one of those situations where she's going to be tokenized on the way in and scapegoated on the way out. And we've seen a history of that in race relations.
Candy, thank
you. I saw this as a best case scenario in my mind, just with the discussion over the past few years, or I would say even the decade, about the Governor General position being such a token position. I thought, for two reasons, Mary Simon coming in. You know, Candy, you and I met when I was hosting Canada Reads. I host Canada Reads every year. We often have Indigenous panelists on Canada Reads panel. And I've noticed how much You spoke about this, Melissa, about the pride of the communities that they come from. So there's the broader Indigenous community and the pride there, and then the, you know, the micro communities they come from, and there's so much pride, but then there's also pressure for the person, the people in these various roles to do their various communities proud. And so I felt like Mary Simon is in a position to possibly, hopefully, make some changes that would make her communities and broader communities proud. And I also love it because as a Quebecer, French-speaking, but Anglophone Quebecer originally, I love the fact that this had, you know, a lot of French-speaking people in arms about like, well, she doesn't speak French. So what, dude? Deal with it. She speaks other languages that aren't French. How about that? And I really
like
that.
Well, she speaks one of our first languages, which is even more impressive in a way, isn't it? I love what everyone's saying, but I have to keep, I go back to thinking about Mary Simon's CV. It is impressive. In fact, it's more impressive than past governor generals that we've had. So it could be partly symbolic, but if we know anything, symbols do matter, and she's more than qualified to do it. So if not Mary Simon, then who? Especially right now.
Yeah. Well, my solution would be it's gone altogether. That we don't have a governor general.
I hear what you're saying in terms of symbolism, Jess, and I think that for symbolism, in terms of Mary Simon and what she can achieve, it remains to be seen, and that is something we can look forward to. In terms of other Canadians, though, as a Canadian, I will say over the last week, I've seen like wall-to-wall coverage of this process, right? The story, the profiles. Every time I turn on the news, every time I go online to a Canadian website, it's right there. I don't remember this attention being given to a previous appointee, unless there was a scandal for governor general. And I think to myself, well, just a few weeks ago, we were seeing wall-to-wall coverage of the discoveries at the former residential schools. And so my worry in terms of symbolism and what people and viewers take away is that, oh, we have now wallpaper or wrapping paper over a wound, a rot, and that. And people do this all the time, right? We saw it in the South with Barack Obama, and people were like, he was elected, racism is solved. And I just worry that those who haven't, you know, taken the time to understand this issue, who may not have taken it as seriously, will point to this and be like, we're done. And it will result in complacency.
Yeah. Listen, we're going to continue to watch this and see if the role does in fact change under her leadership, for sure. Listen, for some, it's deep into wedding season. And for people who are slowly getting weddings back online in a more traditional sense, here's a story for you. There was a bridesmaid who wrote to Slate after she accidentally texted the bridal group chat instead of a private one-on-one chat with another bridesmaid. And she was basically saying, oh, this bride is out of control. So she's asking Slate, what does she do now? Does she just kind of meekly put her tail between her legs and drop out of being a bridesmaid? Or perhaps there's another piece of advice. We will throw this out to the group. What would you do in her situation?
My advice would be to ghost. Sorry, say it again, Candy.
People have to stop cutting one another down in text. This happens all the time. You end up texting the last person you were texting with instead of the person you think you were texting with. So just stop doing it. And sisters out there, stop being so passive aggressive. Just go to your girl and say, love ya, want to stand with ya, you're killing me. This is costing me too much. I can't afford a Vegas wedding. You know, you want a champagne wedding, I can afford a beer wedding. Decide whether you want me
in
or out.
She did once. Like, she said to the bride, this is so expensive. And then the bride was like, oh, okay, I'll just investigate cheaper options. And then the jewelry thing came in.
Yeah, she's just got to be a hard liner with that. But don't cut other people down on text. You're going to get busted.
Yeah, there's a couple of lessons.
Okay, so
manage your texting and also manage your relationships and your communications with your close friends.
You guys, this is fine advice for this girl now after this has happened, but it's already happened. I hope she takes the advice that you're giving, but moving on from this point, her only option is to ghost everyone, move to a different town, forget that she knows anyone. There's no coming back from this. I would be devastated, gutted, like bye-bye, new job, new city, new friends.
Oh, no, I know you, Jess. I feel like you would do, what probably the right thing, the adult thing to do is to just go straight up to the bride face to face and just like confess and say, listen, I'm really sorry that you had to see that, but this is getting out of control. Like, I know that that's, it makes me cringe just thinking of doing that, but we all know that on paper, that's the right thing to do. And at that point, if, you know, the bride is still out of control, then you can respectfully say, well, then this is not in my budget. I wish I could stand for you at your wedding, but I need to back off because I can't go broke. I got to pay rent or a mortgage and I'm dying here just to be a part of your wedding. So there it is. Hey, Ali, you are hosting the JFL conference. Comedy Night in Canada special. We want to tell everybody this because it is happening tomorrow night in Montreal. And this is a big deal because for a lot of comedians, this is going to be the first time performing for a live audience in a very, very long time. How are you feeling and what can the audience look forward to?
I'm very excited. I did this last year in July. We didn't realize we were going to have 11 more lockdowns. We did this in July. So I know this. You have comedians who are anxious to perform and so excited to do so. And you have audience members who are so pumped to see live comedy. And it's just this perfect storm. It's not going to last long. By September, people will be complaining and heckling and like, oh, there was no stool for my water. I hated it up there. Comedians are going to be. It's going to go down. But this particular moment in time is the best, most perfect time for Just for Laughs. And I'm very happy to be part of it.
Yeah, a lot of people are needing a good laugh break and more indeed. Ali, this has been a ton of fun having you with us. And we want to tell everybody
Thank you so much. You can catch
Ali hosting JFL's Comedy Night in Canada. It streams for free this Friday. That is ha, ha, ha. Let me do that three times. ha.com.
Subscribe to the Social Podcast so you don't miss a fiery debate. Until next time, socialites.